How were the books of the Bible brought together, and does it really matter? This is the story of Jesus. This is lecture 14. How were the books of the Bible brought together, and does it really matter? The books of the Bible were brought together by a diverse series of activities. In most universities, they teach that the Bible is a story of the religious development of a people. The Bible is a story of the religious development of a people. You take the Hindu teachings and you take their Hindu writings, and you find that the Bible there is the development of the religious development of that people. You take the Hebrews from ancient times to the time of Jesus, and you find that the Bible there again was the development of the religious development of a people. And you take the teachings of Muhammad, that too was the development of the religious development of a people. All over the world, wherever the cultures have religious overtones to them, and all cultures do, they have biblical lore, they have lore of the shaman, lore of the gurus and the leaders and the teachers and the various mentors that have come through their life to express what and who that group of people are, what sort of values they have, what sort of intensity they have, what sort of growth experiences they have, what they expect out of life. Very fascinating. When you read that, you get a pretty good idea of what the people believe, and you get a pretty good idea of how the people think and how the people plan their life and what sort of, as I say, values or mores or morals that they live by. And all of them are very beneficial, reasonable, responsible to the people, because it's what the people want. The people want to have some religious leader tell them where to head in. In the beginning, it is the father, maybe the mother, but the father usually in the family, who tells the family what the rules are. And then it is the grandfather, who is the leader of the clan or the leader of the group, and he tells the various children and their families how they're supposed to behave. And then it develops into a more development like a community, and they have industry and they have markets and what have you, and again the government, the mayor, and then when it becomes larger you have the governor, and then you have the president, and then you have the rulers of state, and then you have a diversity taking place where the organization splits aside from the politics of the country to the religion of the country, although that wasn't until recent years. All the time we have the books of the Bible, which are a consistent series of adventures that take place in the life of the people, and they're written down. They're written down by the prophets. They're written down by the, or they're told more likely. They're folk tales, and of course this is an interesting term to put on religion, folk tales, but really that's what they are. They are the tales that the folk tell throughout history, and the people did not have books, they did not have writing, they did not have any way of transmitting information except by telling the story. And so the storyteller was one of the greatest methods or techniques of bringing knowledge from one generation to another, or bringing traditions or manners in which life is to be lived from one generation to another. And sometimes the storytellers were charming and delightful and wonderful and uplifting and exciting. Other times the storytellers felt that they were supposed to be the right hand of God and supposed to make sure that everyone behaved and not just tell them what the rules are, but make sure they followed them. And sometimes this placed the shaman, the storytellers, into the light of being healers. And they became the ones who took care of the healing needs of people. And they would create beautiful scenarios of healing with flashing gunpowder type of material, with flashing lights, with the ability to put poofs onto the fire and make it come up into a great piece of smoke for a short moment. And the magic that they performed was supposed to really scare the living daylights out of people and make these people come to terms with themselves. You can understand how all these people were living in such a diversity of attitude and feeling and thinking, and that's fine. And as they did these things, they made, what would you say, spiritual icons out of them. And in making the spiritual icon out of the experiences that they had, which were used to keep them in line, they began to worship these icons. And so they worshipped womanhood. They worshipped the grain, the corn, and they would have a worship ceremony before they planted the seed, saying that they wanted God to bless them as they put that corn into the ground, that it would bring a great harvest, and that it would bring a harvest that would be a joy and a pleasure to everyone. And they said all these things. And they were very wonderful, very significant. It became pageantry. It became ritual. It became the excitement of the church. And many times, its real purpose was forgotten. Its real purpose was forgotten because, as with the Jews on their eating of pork, there was a time when trichinosis was rampant in the pork that was available in the Holy Lands, and the priest said, just no pork. They cannot eat pork ever again. They couldn't say, you cannot eat pork for a period of time until the trichinosis is no longer in the meat, because they didn't know that. And they didn't know that the trichinosis was what was doing it, and that it eventually would go away. They had no idea of knowing that, and so they just put a carte blanche idea that no pork. And that's why today even, the Jews just do not have pork in their diet. It's a very interesting thing. And it doesn't make pork good or bad or indifferent. It just makes it something that religious token has brought down through the years and made to be what it is. Now, I believe that in the verbal report of the stories of the Bible, of the Old Testament, that have come down to us, that it depends on where you come into the story that you have it. Now, they like to say Genesis is the beginning, and they like to say the Book of Laws was important as establishing laws, but these laws were all not written at one time. They were written over a series of generations and a series of thousands of years, but they were all boiled down into the Book of Laws, and they were all put down as though they had come at one time through one series of prophets and kings. And many of the other books were written in the same manner. Wherever the flavor of the book was consistent, it was put together with other books that were consistent with its flavor. And this is how the books of the Bible were brought together. This is how they were brought out, because they were just words. They were just reports, stories that were given by the people who were the speakers of these words. And so they would gather together all consistent things together and put it together in one book, and lo and behold, we would have the information rather balanced. And that is a benefit, I guess. However, the only difficulty comes is that they worship the book. We worship the Bible. We worship these things, and we say that they are sacrosanct and they cannot be touched and they should never be spoken against or never be changed. And of course, they're being changed constantly. Every time the Bible is being reprinted, it's being changed. Changes of new language, of new interpretation, of new definitions, and many times things are said and it sounds so gruesome in today's language, whereas in olden times it was a common situation. In the Hebrew teachings, the Jews were accustomed to say many things, by the beard of my father, you can believe in the truth that I'm telling you, and many other statements that they made, and many other angry statements that they made that don't need to be repeated. But these statements became idioms. It became part of their language, part of their teaching technique, and they were part of the Bible. And as days grew on, and they no longer needed those idioms, those language ideas, they discarded them. And so if we were to, of course you never could, but if we were to be able to take every single book of the Bible and see it through its various generations, millennia in fact, of activity, we would be amazed at how much it changed and how much the essence, not only the essence of it changed, but the facts of it changed. The essence is the ideal, the principle behind it, the purpose of it. And the facts are those bits of information that support that purpose. And both change so dramatically and so interestingly that we would never recognize it as the same book. Yet it is. So, we're not here to discuss whether the Bible is right or wrong or good or bad or beneficial or non-beneficial. We know the Bible is beneficial because it is a book that gives people some sort of stability. Now, if, we haven't come to the New Testament yet, but if the Old Testament fathers could have learned to meditate, learned to introspect, and listen within to their own Bible within them, and take the information of the Bible that they have within them and use it as the guiding principle for their communities and their organizations, wow, what a fabulous guidebook they would have. Now, that would take some very deep introspective work and some very conclusive introspective work. And many people who do that and have done that, they did not have the charisma and the clout, the ability to put through what they have learned and make it into a principle for the group. They put little bits of it in there, but not a lot of it, because the people miss the old-time religion, you know? They miss those gospel songs. The gospel songs are so beautiful and so uplifting and so supportive and not supportive, depending upon what the song is, but they're familiar with it. It harkens back to a stability of time before television, before radio, before many wars that had taken place that we understood. Now we understand war and we know pretty much just what it is. War is an economic activity that takes place within any group of communities who do not agree economically with each other. It's a very fascinating thing. It has nothing to do with right, wrong, good, bad, or indifferent. It's just who has the greatest economic clout, the greatest economic power to bring it to pass. Okay, so if, and they haven't, but if the early leaders of the community, the wheels of the community, could have spent more time in introspection, listening within, and being guided by that within, they would have been fantastic. And their rule would have been the rule like the rule of Solomon and the rule of other great kings who were introspective rulers, great rulers, rulers like sages. So, that's where the Bible is. That's how the Bible lays. That's how the Old Testament stands. And it's not bad, it's not good, it's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And remember, whenever you think of the Old Testament, if you can think the Old Testament is the result of many storytellers telling stories, you will look at it quite differently. You will not look at it as something that cannot be changed or that cannot be judged. You just look at it as a story. And the story was told in its time for a purpose. Noah and the Ark. Why was Noah and the Ark told? It was a matter of getting the people in order, getting the people in balance, getting the people to follow the rules. Why did Abraham do that with his son? It's getting his son to follow his rules. Why did they show God as kicking Adam and Eve out of the kingdom of heaven? Out of Garden of Eden? It was a matter of obeying the rules, obeying the rules. You see, it's always obeying the rules. Always obeying the rules. And the stories are basically irrational. They are basically not based on reason, because Adam and Eve were the first two people on earth. Adam and Eve did not have any children while they were in the Garden of Eden. After they left the Garden of Eden, they had two children, boys, no girls. And then the boys, that is the remaining boy, came. He went away and he married a girl. And he had children. He had a family. Where did he find this girl? This girl wasn't from Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve were the only two human beings on the face of the earth. You see, so the logic breaks down quite quickly on these things. And, oh, it's okay. Understand, it's just a matter of keeping order in the community, keeping order in the world. And so they tell these stories. And the more simplified the story, the better. The more simplified of having one God, it was good. And, of course, true. And then having just Adam and Eve as the first mother and father of the universe is good, except they weren't really the mother and father because they only had boys. If they had a boy and a girl and they had a mixed marriage of that nature, then they might have been the parents of the universe, but they weren't, you see? So the logic falls away, but that's okay. We don't mind that. We just say, okay, they're the parents of the universe and they're this and they're that, and we're happy with that. Now, again, the amusement goes on. The amusement goes on because along comes Moses, and he leads the people out of Egypt, and he treads them for 40 years in the desert so that the generations will die out who had been slaves, and the generations that he takes with him into the Holy Land will be ones who did not know slavery and will not think of themselves ever as slaves. They forgot the Holocaust. They forgot all of the problems of the Second World War. They forgot all of the problems. And they're totally doomed, totally different. Unfortunately, Moses kept telling them the story of all these things, and so they put that into the books of the Bible, and then they limited themselves with it. But they were supposed to totally forget that and be born new in the land of milk and honey. Except Moses had a wrong idea of the land of milk and honey. The land of milk and honey was there, and he could have gone there. He found it in the desert with the manna from God in the desert, the food that came out of nowhere. And he fed his people. He did many things. But the first thing he did when he got back to civilization was to be a naughty boy. He said, you're special. You're special to his people. And they were special. And he said, because you're special, you can go and take any city you want. Just go in and take the city. Kill all the people, dump them out of there, get rid of them, you know, stack them up like cordwood, get them out of there, and it's your city. And that's when Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, remember? Mm-hmm. And the walls came tumbling down. Well, now, as the people marched around the city of Jericho, their footprints, their footsteps, caused the vibrations which caused the walls to tumble down. Or maybe God caused the walls to tumble down. Maybe Moses caused the walls to come tumbling down. Maybe Joshua, who fit the Battle of Jericho, caused the walls to come tumbling down. We don't know. It maybe an earthquake did. Maybe something reasonable, maybe something unreasonable. So it doesn't matter. And I doubt, as the scene presents itself to our eyes, that here is a walled city. And as the Israelites walked around it, the walls totally came tumbling down. Well, now, you and I know that doesn't work that way. The walls fall this way and that way. They have breaches in the wall. You can go through it. You can walk through it. And the eyes of the needle on the different walls of the different gates, they fell down. And maybe the big opening for the front gate where the tax collector was working, that could easily fall down. And so the Israelites came marching in there and said, okay, out, boys. If you don't go out, we'll put your lights out. And so most of the people left, and they went to their own relatives in other cities, and continued living. But a good many of them were killed by the zealous, peace-loving people of Moses. Fascinating, huh? Okay, now the story goes on. And it goes on and goes on. And in the house of David, who came out of that? Jesus is supposed to come out of the house of David. Now, was the house of David a good house? Oh, it had lots of problems. It had lots of problems, and it still does. And why does it have problems? Because it does not use its own mind to create whatever things it wants to have in itself. It's constantly trying to force other people to do things. I have made this statement, and I've made it and will continue to make it, and it is one that I'm sure a lot of people love me for, but I believe that around the world, the Jewish people are so abundant, and I don't mean the number, the Jewish people have such control over all the money of the world that if they wanted to, they could just go down and buy Israel. They could go down and buy the country themselves. You say, well, people wouldn't sell it. As a mass, no. As an individual, yes. So I go up to Edith here and I say, Edith, I like your apartment. And she says, I do too. I said, Edith, I like your apartment very much. She says, I do too. I said, Edith, what do you pay for rent? She says, $1,000. I said, okay, Edith, I'll give you $1,200. And Edith says, don't be silly. I like my apartment. I said, or I'll give you $1,500. Well, now, don't be so silly, you know. And I'll give you $2,000. Yes, it's yours. You know? You can buy anything. Anything at all. People sold their mothers. They sold their children. They sold the family jewels. They sold everything. You understand? I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying when you have a desire for something, the way is there for you to accomplish it if you wish, even though people might say, never in my life would I ever give up my control of this piece of property. This is my dad's property. This is this pile of rock here that I can't raise anything on, that even the sheep don't like it. So this is the heritage of my family. I'm going to hang on to it. And then you take them on a vacation, and you take them to Europe, or you take them to Africa, you take them to America, and you show them the vast plains of it, and you show them where the sheep are richly eating at the meadows and so forth. And they say, wow, I didn't know there were places like this. Well, you give me your piece of land, and I'll give you 10 acres right here. I'll give you 100 acres. And the 100 acres is worth a medium amount of money. And what you want is you want to build up owning all of Jerusalem, all of Israel. And how do you do it? You just go in and buy it. So when people complain that they have lost their homeland and it's no longer theirs, I say, go buy it. Go buy it. And they will never do this. They will never buy it, because there's another aspect of the Jewish culture that doesn't allow that. And that is they have to have their wailing wall. They have to feel sorry. They have to cry and wail over something. And they do. No. The Jews are not alone there. We come in a close second on that sort of stuff. We cry over things that we shouldn't cry about either. Like, oh, my husband died. Sure he died. You fed him all that rich food and you encouraged him to never go out and wrestle and run and jump and play horseback and do things. You made a sedentary creature out of him and his body just died. I did that? Yes, you did that. Every time he says, I think I'll go play golf, you said, oh, must you? I'd rather have you be at home. I think I'll go and play poker with the boys. At least get out of the house and walk, you know, to the poker place. And no, you shouldn't do that. And whatever was said, you see. And then we are upset about it. They say, well, what has this got to do with how the books of the Bible were laid out? Well, that's how the books of the Bible of our life are laid out. Just by simple little things like that. Just by simple little things. If Moses had said to the people coming to the land of milk and honey, now you go in and industriously build your own nation. You go in and you buy property. You go in and you take over. Now, Herb, they didn't have money. They didn't. Knock it off. I don't believe you. Do you know that these Koreans come over here to America. They haven't got a penny in their pockets. In 10 years, they own a large business industry, and they own houses in which they live, and they are rich. Do you know that the Japanese come over here with a modicum of money, and little by little, they want to be someplace, and they're not represented in that neighborhood. That neighborhood has no Japanese in it at all. And they buy up houses and buy up houses, and they buy up business and industry, and pretty soon you have your Japaneseville, you know. It's a community mainly of Japanese people, which is great, you know. And so we say it can't be done. All you need to do is be like a Chinese, is be like a Korean, is be like a Japanese, is be like a Asian. The Asians come over here and they have nothing, nothing, nothing. And they live in their tight little community and they build. And as they build property ownership, they build commercial business ownership, they build everything. And if before you know it, they are running for governor. Before you know it, they're Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know? And that's true. That's true. He came over here from Austria as a weightlifter, and he was good at it. But next thing you know, over the years, he became the president's counsel for physical health. He became a movie star of great, great desire. The people loved him. And then he became all sorts of things. Now he's the governor of California. Next, the president of the United States, if it works out. And he'll probably have it work out. But you see, what's so wonderful about this? It's what's so wonderful is that he didn't accept no as the answer. He didn't accept that it was impossible. And the Jews didn't have to accept it as impossible that they go and build their own nation on other people's land, but they build their own nation. But look at here, the land down there was vast and broad and just as barren as the land that they got. And they could have done wonderful things, and they still can if they wish. And I, for one, say, Godspeed. I give you my blessings. Go and do it. The wetbacks come through our property here, international travelers we call them, and as we see them occasionally, we say in our heart, bless you and go your way and become prosperous and multiply. go your way and become prosperous and enjoy life. And we have nothing against them, but they don't stop on our property because it's against the law for them to do that. If they stop here and we, help them, then we are contributing to aliens seeking to come into the United States illegally, and that's not acceptable. So we just bless them physically, mentally, and let them go their way, but do nothing for them. And we have lots of water faucets around our property. If they're thirsty, they can turn it on, let it run for a moment, and they'll have lots of water to drink. We have 6 houses here which have 6 wells, and we got 7th well for the prairie, and we let them be. Now, Moses could have had that same thing for his people. All nations can have that same thing for them. All you have to do is show a little initiative, show a little desire. I think these Mexican people who come over here are the most crazy people in the world, because they come and they take the menial job, the meanest job that we have to offer, and they send money home to feed their families. Yeah, pretty cool, huh? We don't think it's enough to live on. We think it's poverty living on that amount of money that they earn, and yet they take the majority of what they earn and send it home to their families. You see, where there is a desire in your heart to do anything, you can do it beautifully. You can do it beautifully. Now, in the putting together of the New Testament, we have a whole other story here. You would think that the Jews would say, let's hang on to Jesus. You know, he's our rabbi. He's our native son. He's showing signs of building up a following, and it's great. Let's hang on to him. But no, they discarded him. And in discarding him, he had to walk alone. That is, his philosophy had to walk alone. And the people who loved it got behind it. And Australia is the stupidest country in the world. They got all of the bad people from England, all the convicts, all of the evil people from England, and they went down and they made out of the desert of Australia, they made a heaven on earth. And the people who are in the governing positions of Australia, just after the prisoners went down there, the prisoners, they themselves became the governors of Australia. And they became the chief legislators, the chief executives, they became all these things. And you see, what the England had meant as to get rid of the evil forces, Australia said, hey, let's make princes out of them. Now, in America, all of the people who couldn't get along in other countries, they came over to America. Everybody who couldn't get along with their home, with their personal friends, their relations, they came over to America. All of the what do you call it, the people who had a hang-up, you know, one sort or another, and they came over, and the first thing they did was to take the highest principles they could and set it as their goal and then go for it. And America became a nation, as it still is, of high quality and high goals and high desires, and people respect it and love it because America stands for truth as it understands it. And that's great. Now, Australia did the same thing. New Zealand did the same thing. All the countries of the world virtually did the same thing. Wherever prison colonies were formed, the people in, who were in the prisons ran the colony, and it became a very noteworthy integrity-filled organization. They say, how could that happen? Well, because prisoners are not evil people. They may have done stupid things, but when they find themselves in a situation where they got to have a different attitude toward life, they figure it out. If a prisoner knew that driving down the street at too high a speed endangered himself, he would not drive so fast. But the thing is, they just thought they were going against the grain of everybody else, and that's why they did it. Okay, back to the New Testament. The New Testament, which is the story of Jesus, which is the books of the Bible that are written about the life of Jesus and about the time of Jesus and about the teachings of Jesus, were nothing. Were nothing. Naturally, Jesus didn't have any writers. He didn't have any people doing this. The first person who wrote anything at all about the teachings of Jesus was who? Huh?
Paul.
And Paul never met Jesus. Paul had no idea who Jesus was. He had his illumination on the road to Damascus when the light flashed in his eyes and he became blind. And the voice said to him, Paul, why persecutest thou me? And the voice was Jesus, Paul said. Well, now, Paul had such a hang-up that he thought the voice of Jesus was talking to him and saying to him, Paul, start doing righteous things, start doing good things. And so Paul was so shook up. After he got his sight back, he went to work on behalf of the sharing of the teachings of Jesus as he understood them. And he didn't understand. He had never heard them. He understood them only intuitively, listening to the divine within him sharing its goodness. And not bad, not bad. That's the way Jesus did it too. But Paul should have had the work of Paul, the life of Paul, the times of Paul, but he didn't. And so he traveled the Caribbean. He traveled the Mediterranean, and he went from town to town, and he spoke, and he carried the message that he believed in. And he tried to associate with Peter, who was the right hand of Jesus and the rock upon which Jesus said he'd found the church. And Peter wouldn't have anything to do with him. And so he went off on his own, and he did his thing. But he sent the letters back from him to Peter and to the people, and they were made into a book, and they were added into teachings. But you see, they weren't written. The letters were written, that's true. But the letters were taken down by listening and reading them, and then told to the people. And much of it didn't make sense to them because they were told about the culture of the Romans and the Greeks up around the Mediterranean Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea. And so they had to revise the sayings that Paul wrote. revise the teachings in line with the people who lived in the country of Israel. And so this went on and on and on. About 50, 60 years after the resurrection of Jesus, Matthew, apparently, had written the story of the life of Jesus as he understood it. And Matthew was, of course, getting to be pretty old. And as he was writing, he was getting a little senile, and he didn't say everything perfectly like he could, but he did a pretty good job. And so, from the book of Matthew, other writers who were more ingenious and more interested in certain aspects of Jesus, like when John was interested in the legal aspects of it and the background and giving a facility to Jesus to say that he came from the house of David and that he was born out of these things and that he was out of the virgin birth and all that good stuff. And you see, John didn't pay too much attention to that, but Jesus did. Matthew did. And Matthew did, and so did Mark and Luke. But Mark and Luke didn't, because they were Johnny-come-latelys, and they had no idea of anything except what they read in Matthew. And because everybody who was concerned with Jesus or aware of Jesus was dead. Peter was dead long time before. Peter died within a very few years after Jesus went. And all these various people that Jesus had been around, they moved on too. And it's not bad, it's not good, it's just that they moved on. So as these books were written, there was maybe 200 or 300 of them. Yeah, 200 or 300 books written about the times of Jesus. These all went to the formation of the new church in where? In Rome. And the new church in Rome went over these books and decided which ones were valid and which ones were not. And they filed away the ones they didn't believe were valid, or they take a little bit here and a little bit there, and they made it up. And the various councils worked on these things very assiduously and very carefully, but it wasn't real. Because somebody like Herb Barley might have come along and said, let me tell you my thought about the life of Jesus Christ. Let me tell you how I look at Jesus Christ and how I look at his world and his time and his life. And I can be very right. I can be very real. I can have a one-on-one relationship with Jesus. Or I could have been there, having been universal as we all are. I could have been there in the very presence of Jesus, in the very presence of this divinity. And as I was there in the presence of it, I could be aware of it. But when you are in the presence of something and you are aware of something, are you aware of it? No. Only if you're told to write it down, or only if you're taking a major part in it. Now, if you were not Peter, if you were not a disciple, you would not have the slightest idea what Jesus taught. And have you noticed? Jesus taught 3 years, and he taught a lot of stuff. We hear only 5 or 6 areas of what he taught. We don't hear the in-depth talks that he gave to the disciples. We don't hear the in-depth talks that he gave to individual people that he spoke to who were ready to hear the divinity that he could reveal to them. We don't hear those things. We don't hear those things because the people who were there were so fascinated and so listening to what he had to say, they never thought to write it down. Now, here we have Swami Rama, and he lived in the Himalayas, and he lived with his master. We hear how his master went to his mother and father and said that when he is so old, he will be coming to live with the Swami, whether to live with the Guru, and work and learn and become a rabbi, Swami Rama, to become a Swami. And so the mother and father says, yeah, sure, you're going to get our son like nothing. Well, they died, and he got him. They were in some sort of an accident, and they died, totally unexpected, and so the guru got him. Now, the guru told the story to Rama, otherwise he wouldn't have known. And then the guru taught the kid. And the kid was not a very nice kid. He was a rapscallion. He didn't do what he was told all the time, and he wasn't obedient and a lot of other things, but enough. So he finally did succeed. And so he wrote the story. Now, tell me, anybody, what's the name of the guru that trained him?
Vidyanath.
Interesting, isn't it? Here, this marvelous mind, this marvelous intelligence that gave him all of the genius, didn't give him the genius, but inspired him to express the genius that he was. We never know about him. Oh, I'm sure someplace it's written down, someplace it's said, but in all the books that I've read about him, it didn't dwell upon that to any length. So here you have a man who lived with a master who was a super, super guy, who trained this young man, Rama, in all of these great and wonderful things, and beautiful things. If you will be reading the Living with the Himalayan Masters book that Rama wrote. And he's a great guy, but you have no idea who he is. He has no following. He has no legacy, so to speak, except in a Rama. And Rama's gone now, too. But you see, what are all these things? What are all these things? Jesus had a philosophy that was so tremendous that it stands through the centuries, even poorly brought down, even poorly related to. Now, what can any of you tell me, and we're having lots of fun here, what can any of you tell me Jesus taught to the world that many another did not teach? Or what was one of the primary things of what Jesus taught? And say it.
The kingdom of God is within.
I am God. The kingdom of God is within. God is within me. The Father's in me. The kingdom's within me. I ask and see and speak and knock and it opens to me. It's done unto me according to my belief. Those simple, simple things. Happily, they come through even with the Bible messed up the way it is. But they come through. And they work. They are beautiful, they are fantastic, they are glorious. Now, they're scattered through the four Gospels, basically in Matthew and a lot in John, and they come through quite nicely, but they are just breezed over. They're not spoken of as a great masterpiece, which, because they're not spoken of as a great masterpiece, perhaps has given them the life that they have, because if they were extolled, if they were uplifted, if they were encouraged in our thinking, the church would long have discarded it, because it would, if you do that, you don't need a church. If you do that, you don't need someone else to guide you on your path. If you know that within you is all wisdom, all knowledge, and if you know that God is in you, what else do you need? Now, people say, well, Herb, you're teaching heresy, you're teaching this, you're teaching that. Hey, I don't care what you say. I'm just teaching what I believe, and I'm teaching what happens to coincidentally be the same thing that Jesus taught. Coincidentally, you know. Coincidentally. And so, how can you knock it? How can you knock it when it's right there in black and white, and with me, it's in flesh and blood, and it's great. And with you, it's flesh and blood too. With you, it's fantastic. With you, it's glorious. Now, do you want it to be that way? Do you want to live your life from a fabulous point of view? Well, then, don't worry about the books of the Bible, and certainly don't worry about reading anything other than the words of Jesus, because if that's the guide that you would like in your life, then go for it. Don't go reading Paul, because Paul was trying to come to terms with himself throughout his entire life. And he did good stuff. And Paul did have a good pen. Remember 1 Corinthians 13? Yeah. And many other beautiful things that Paul had written. Read those things. Enjoy them. But basically, leave them alone. Just go to Matthew. And just go to John if you wish, but basically Matthew. And you'll get a pretty good story. and you'll have a pretty good understanding. And then, as we do in reading Illusions by Richard Bach, when the Messiah's Handbook comes up, bung, out comes a beautiful statement, out comes a beautiful statement, out comes a beautiful statement. As you read about the life of Jesus, and if you read about his Sermon on the Mount and his other great teachings, bung, out will come these fabulous statements that will just turn you upside down and make you say, hallelujah, that's wonderful. You see, this is who you are. This is what you are. This is where you're going. This is what is important in your life. And you are important. You are important. How was the book put together? It says here, how were the books of the Bible brought together? And does it matter? I've given you a pretty good idea of how the Old Testament was brought together. And I could go into a greater and greater depth with that, but it's not necessary. And how the New Testament was brought together. It was whatever the church felt was going to make the people dependent upon the church, which was left in there. The book of Matthew they had to put in there because they had to have that foundation. But the rest of it, they have revised it and changed it so that it would be perfect. Now, people oftentimes, in listening to me and hearing what I have to say, they say, Herb, today you're saying this and tomorrow you're saying that. And I say, no. Today I'm saying this based upon humanity. Tomorrow I'm saying that based upon our divinity. Now, is our humanity and our divinity the same thing? Can it be? It can be. But if it is, then what is going to be the weak sister there? Humanity. Our divinity will be our strength. All is in divine order. All is in divine order. All is in divine order. And these are the things that we will say. This is a real book. But again, if you really want to get going on the Bible, start looking within yourself. And the computer business has a special a program, that you put a microphone in front of your face and you start speaking into the microphone, telling what your inner Bible has to say. And start out at the beginning, what your inner Bible has to say. And then it will immediately put it in type for you. It will immediately put it on typed sheets, so to speak. And they're getting so that it's almost good now, where you don't have to go back over it too badly, like you do with the scanning. And the scanning is getting pretty good now, too. But you see how wonderful that is. How wonderful that is. And it's up to us to make the claim upon it and enjoy it and experience it. And can you do that?
Yes.
Sure. Do you want to do that?
Yes.
Sure. Why haven't you done it? Sure. We can, we will, and we are. But again, let's conclude this with another point. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the Old Testament says, the New Testament says, what the Upanishads say, Bhagavad Gita says, doesn't matter what the teachings of the Mormons or the whoever, it doesn't matter. All that it matters is who you listen to. And if you listen to God within you, if you listen to the divine within you, you will never, ever, ever go wrong. I don't say that there won't be people chasing after you, but you will never go wrong. Because people love to slaughter, stop, inhibit anybody who is a free spirit, you know? And that's great. We look at our John Dainty as a free spirit and we think, what a character, no responsibility, why doesn't he do this? And he's having a ball.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother him in the slightest. And we look at Anita was a little squeaky mouse, and she came here and I worked with her for quite a while, and she changed from that squeaky mouse to a self-confident woman who is doing her own thing, having a ball, being herself. Now, I worked with her. I'm not trying to take the credit, but I worked with her to let go of the mouse. But she loved that mouse. And she, you know, and we got her to let go of that mouse. And when she let go of that mouse, she turned out beautiful. And we've done that with others. We're working on Ingeborg. We just got started. We were only 30 years on the project of having her let go of that mouse and be that independent being that she can be. You accept, huh?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. But you see, this is what I do with all of you. I do this with Sylvia too. And Sylvia gets so upset with me because I see Sylvia as the fabulous genius, the amazing woman, the creative master that she is. And she says, "Herb, you never say nice things about me." I say it about her, but I haven't figured out the words to quite reach the level where she's at. You know what I mean? I've got to get up there to where she is, and I'll throw it at her. And then all of a sudden, she'll say, "You made it. You got it. You know, I believe you got it." And that's great, isn't it? And that's great. Dodie came here with a lot of preconceived ideas, and her preconceived ideas were that she was not as beautiful, fantastic, and glorious as she is. But she's learning. She's learning that anything she wants to do, she can do. She knew that all along, and now she's doing it unlimitedly. And Dodie is going to open up her purse of unlimited wealth and go out and feed the hungry who need sweet rolls every day and take care of them. Right? Right?
Right, right.
Dodie?
Yes.
Did you ever pay for any of the food that you took to those people? I think you did.
I don't know. It cost me a lot of gas.
See how she says gas, you see? But here she is giving generously to the elderly who enjoy sweet rolls, which are not good for them, and she takes it to them, and she says, because they want it. And you see, now the day is going to come when she is going to go to Henry's and the health food stores, and she's going to take them sprouts, and she's going to take them all sorts of health food type things, and they will look at her, and you know what they'll say? They'll say, "Dodie, you're our savior. Thank you." Dr. Edmund Bardot Seke, who had the first property that we had when we came up here, 80 acres of the Mille de Montal de Meditation, beautiful place. And so we lived there for a couple of years. And he's a medical doctor. He'd been in Sorbonne and many other places. And one of his assignments was to go to a Polynesian island, which was a cancer colony. And so he went to this, not cancer, leprosy colony, a leprosy colony, you know, not a very nice place. And these people were losing their noses, their eyes, there. And so he went in there. And when he went in there, the staff that was there was maybe four or five people. They said, "Hooray, you're here!" And then they took off on their first vacation in years and left him alone without any advice on anything that was going on there. And so he said, very introspective man. And so he said, "Okay, what should I do here?" And then he listened. And the voice inside of him said, "Get these people together and have them help you throw all the canned goods in the ocean." And so he had a lot of canned goods there, which was their staple to eat. And he threw it all in the ocean, all, just random, and tons of it. And then he said, the voice said to him, "Feed them the fruit of the trees." And so he began feeding them, what?
Mangoes
and pineapples and whatever names you can come up. Coconuts, yeah, lots of coconuts. And within 2 weeks, every one of the people was out of their bed. And within a month before the people came back, all the people were on their way to total perfect health. Now, you say, how could he do that? Well, he did it because he believed in himself and they believed in him. They said, our Savior has come. And he has done this in other areas of his life too. But that was one that was so beautiful. Another time he was his shipwrecked in the Caribbean Ocean, Caribbean Sea. And the ship went down. And he and the captain and two crewmen found themselves on an island. And so here they are on this island with nothing but some weeds and grass and what have you, in the middle of the Caribbean. And so they had nothing to drink, nothing to eat, nothing to do or anything. And so about the fourth morning there, he was down on all fours, and he's licking the leaves of the plants on the ground that were growing on the ground. And the captain comes up to him and says, Edmund, are you okay? Do you have a problem or something, Edmund? And Edmund looked up and said, nope, I'm having a drink. Well, what are you drinking? I am drinking every drop of moisture that is exuded from these leaves here. And he says, and I feel good. And next thing you know, all four guys were down there on all fours licking the leaves every morning. And it gave them enough moisture in their bodies to survive until they were picked up. But you see, he listened. He listened within. He listened to the divine within. These are in his books. That's why I know all these things. And plus, I know him. And he listened, and he did just wonderful. And on his 88th birthday, he was visiting with the president of Costa Rica in a big hotel in Costa Rica. And they had a great talk. He gets with a lot of important people. And they walked out of the hotel, and they got in their car and drove away from the hotel. And at just that moment, an earthquake struck, and the hotel went twing straight down to the ground. And so he said, I do believe I ought to get my house in order and get all of my investments in order and get all of my things in order, which he did. And you see, you listen to your divine within. He should have listened without having the hotel fall down, but the hotel was a memory jogger for him. And we all have little memory joggers. And the Bible can be a memory jogger for us if we want. But don't worship it. Worship the divine book within you and watch your miracles take place. On that note, we will say, how about discussion and lunch? Or lunch and discussion, or lunch, or whatever. I love you. I love you.
I love you.
I love you.